The Joyful Friar podcast is made possible by the generous support of our friends. To support the podcast, please visit nathan-castle.com and donate today. Hi, and welcome to this episode of the Joyful Friar podcast. I'm Father Nathan Castle, your host. Today's episode is the third in a three-part trilogy. This story is from book three, and it's chapter seven. It's that chapter is called Sylvia, Who Was Grieving Her Husband and Daughter, and Angel Amelie. So to get the real benefit of this episode, I'd recommend that you go back to the previous two. In the first of these of this trilogy, I just lay out the basic story that Sylvia presented. She came in a dream in a night and showed me, or made me feel her emotions, feel what it was like to wake up in the middle of the night just to use the restroom. But she not only woke up to that, she woke up to crushing grief that was with her all the time. It was particularly in the dream, the soundtrack of it was a record on a turntable, and the song was Natalie Cole singing Unforgettable, which is it's a love song, but it's in a minor key, and it's about someone you love being on your mind so much that you couldn't possibly ever forget them. But in Sylvia's case, she couldn't forget them, even though they died suddenly in a car crash. Her husband and her about 2-year-old daughter walked out the door and died. And so being unforgettable was a very, very mixed blessing for her, because she had loved a great deal and lost a great deal. But what she was showing me in the dream was the relentlessness of her grief, and the aloneness that she felt in her home, especially in the dark at night. Well, anyway, as we dealt with her story, she moved in the afterlife after her own passing as a younger woman. She had the help that she needed in the afterlife to grow and emerge from that, and eventually be reunited with her husband and her daughter, although they encouraged her not to make them come back to be the ages that they were for them a couple of decades previous. They said, we've had lots of experiences since we died, and we'd like to catch you up on them, but we don't want to relive everyone. So that's the way that she explained it, that she kind of caught up to them. There was a little of both, that they did some things to allow her to kind of see how they had changed over time, and her daughter had matured in the afterlife, and then said, we'll do some of that with you, but we'd also like you to catch up to us, because we rather enjoy being the way we are now. So anyway, that the fullness of that story is in the book, and it's told a little bit in the first of the three episodes that comprise this trilogy. Last time I did the second part of it was, we call it compassionate response, and I try to particularly, compassion means to suffer with, to approach how this story might be received by people who are suffering deep grief. Today's episode is called, the third part of the trilogy, it's called Spiritual Practice. So I try to give some spiritual or devotional prayer, spiritual practice that maybe would benefit you if you find yourself in a circumstance at all similar to Sylvia's. With that said, not many of us are going to go through a grief as crushing as the one she did, but that doesn't mean that we don't grieve. Sometimes it's the loss of a loved one to death, or in her case, two at one time, but it could be a divorce or an illness or a betrayal or something. That we don't grieve only death. There are other things that cause us to be brokenhearted or in grief. So today I'm trying to address some suggestions that I have that you might find helpful. We'll see. One that I'm starting with is, I'm a semi-contemplative. My order is semi-contemplative, which we were one of the first to leave the monasteries 800 years ago in the early 1200s. So we were our commission was to try to have the spirituality of a monk, but the availability to people to be outside the walls doing public activities and ministry. So I've enjoyed that blend throughout my life. This is my 44th year as a Dominican. So that's been part of the ebb and flow of my life always. And maybe you have something similar to it. Maybe you try to live a life that's both active, productive, helpful, but also reflective and has some quietude and peace about it. You hear it lamented in American culture, where I live, that we run about so much, that we're always doing. Sometimes people will say we're human beings, not human doings, that it's important just to be. Well, part of that blend of action and passion, of activity and quietude, is built into the structure of the life that I've been trained in and that I've lived for so long. One of the disciplines that comes from the monastic tradition that has to do with starting the day is upon wakefulness, as soon as one is aware that one is aware, you know, this morning when you woke up and you realized, oh, I'm awake, one of our disciplines is to pray immediately. Sometimes it's put in the negative to address the morning demons. Have you ever had it happen that soon as you come awake, your first thoughts are troubling or hurtful or frightening or sad? In the monastic tradition, that can happen to anyone, but in the monastic tradition, apparently that happens frequently enough that there's a practice called addressing the morning demons. Whether you think of them as evil spirits that come and try to molest you first thing in the morning to try to get in your thoughts and sadden your day, or whether you believe that's an external agent, like in the cartoon, some demon on your shoulder trying to whisper into your ear, or whether you just think of that as just a part of your psyche, and it doesn't matter. The practice is to address the way that your thoughts are forming in a potentially negative way before they can get traction. So addressing the morning demons, I do that as a Christian in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. I bless myself as soon as I am aware that I'm awake and ask spiritual protection. And I remind myself that I belong to the universe. In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, that I'm beloved of God. The moment I wake up, every day, regardless of season, that I belong to God and I belong here, that it's good to be alive. I pray in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and talk to my Creator and say thank you for a night of sleep, and then begin to rise to the new day. But anyway, taking charge of one's cognition and one's imagination before it has a chance to run away with you. And it doesn't have to be in a negative direction necessarily. It could just be towards workaholism in the first minute of your day. Do you ever wake up to a day and as soon as you're awake, oh my God, I got to get these 10 things done in the next hour. Well, for Kevin's sakes, can't you just kind of slow down a little bit, ease into the day, have a cup of coffee, take a few deep breaths, stretch, splash some water on your face, something to ease into the day, rather than to allow some sort of like inner slave driver to insist that you had better get out of this bed, Missy, and quickly get all these things done. Anyway, addressing the morning demons. One of the ways that I do that is my friend, St. Michael the Archangel. Any of you who are Roman Catholic especially, but he belongs to all Christians in that he is in our scriptures. He's also shows up in the Jewish scriptures and in the Quran in Islam. So he's fairly ecumenical, and I think he's ecumenical beyond just those Abrahamic faiths. He is the colossal universal protector, and he's my friend. So I pray to Saint Michael the Archangel, and there's a prayer that that you can commit to memory that you could find. You could probably Google Saint Michael prayer. It's about protection. When he's depicted in art, and he often is, he's usually depicted as a Roman soldier. So he has the breastplate and the maybe a helmet and kind of a something like, I don't know, they wore something that looks a little bit like a skirt. It might have had leather lats in it or something, and then sandals that come up the leg. He's usually depicted as a Roman soldier of the first century, and then huge wings. He's often has in his hand a spear or a sword, and he's usually depicted as either thrusting the sword or the spear toward a snake, a dragon, or a devil. And sometimes he can look very aggressive in the doing of it, like he's really angry and excited about slaying a dragon. That's not my understanding of him at all. My experience of Michael is that he's a defender, and so he's the patron of police, where we authorize our police to use necessary force to subdue someone who is doing something illegal or violent. But when we catch our police going beyond that and thrashing a suspect or seeming to enjoy inflicting pain on somebody, we suspend them if we catch them in the act of that. That happens a lot, or maybe not a lot, but it recurs, that kind of theme. Well, anyway, Michael is a protector, and he, like good peace officers, wants to keep the peace and wants to keep us safe from anything that would disturb our peace. So when I pray to Michael the Archangel, I just ask for a orb of light to be around me, that I might be protected from anything that I can be protected from. I also follow the crucified Christ, and I don't expect that every day is going to be roses and rainbows. I just say, if I need to suffer anything today, may it at least be authorized or purposeful. Spare me from unnecessary, stupid sufferings, especially in things self-imposed. Help me to move through the day with grace and ease and joy. So anyway, I pray I asked for the defense of Michael the Archangel. It takes about a minute. It took me a long time to describe that, but it takes about a minute. Another thing that one can do, either still in bed or maybe as you move about doing whatever it is you do as you rise, is to find some bit of quiet. It's easier for me because I don't wake up with a spouse or kids. I wake up pretty much in my own little place, and I have control over it largely. There's which would not be the case if I'm waking up with others or responsible for little kids or anything like that. So you might have to do whatever is possible within your own life to find an island of peace early in the morning. Some people enjoy getting up early and having quiet before others waken. Maybe that could work for you. Maybe not. But some people I know enjoy the first hour of the day where they're more or less off duty because they haven't yet had to respond to the needs of others. Whatever time you can take, even if it's just a few minutes, I think it's important to have some sort of focus early in the morning. One of the things that helps a person do, I think, is realize that I'm in charge of me and how my day goes. Maybe not across the board, but nobody's more responsible for me than I am. And so there's an idea of determination, that I'm the one who determines how my day will be. I looked up determination because I love words, and it's related to terminus or terminal, which means an end. The terminal, the bus terminal or the train terminal is the place where the journey ends and you get off. So determination involves end, but it's not just the end of a journey, it's the purpose of a thing, the way that we say the ends justify the means, the idea of the end of a purposeful thought. What would be the end result of a thing that you're proposing to do? So being determined just means I want a particular end. I want a particular thing to happen. St. Thomas Aquinas taught that human acts always incline toward an end. For example, right now, because it's shortly after Easter, our house got loaded up with chocolates and cakes and things. In the next room, there's cake. And I haven't had much to eat yet. I just might be motivated to go get a piece of cake. That might motivate me to get up out of this chair, walk into the next room, and have that piece of cake. The end of that activity is the cake. Well, being determined just means to have an end in mind, a goal in mind. And I think that we can set our determination early in the day to say, I'm going to live in joy today. Now, I know I'm talking to people who might be going through deep grief, and that determination might feel beyond your power when, because grief can be very bossy. Do you remember, were you ever a child that was bossed by other kids? I can remember saying or hearing the phrase from children, "You're not the boss of me." Little kids know that they have bosses, like their mom and their dad or their teacher. But they don't necessarily want to take it from another kid, even a kid that's a little bit older. And you might just stand your ground as a little kid and say, "You're not the boss of me." I think it can be important to be determined to not let grief be the boss of you. Remember, we're talking about Sylvia, who lost her husband and her child. And one of the things that kind of got away from her, it seems to me, from being a part of being brought into her story, is that her grief did become the boss of her, understandably, but still there were other possibilities. And it looks like that at times she felt powerless to steer her grief, that her grief was just something that led her around and that she was the victim of. We just do the best we can, but I think that's part of do you remember at the end of her story, she said this phrase, and several of you have quoted it back to me in recent weeks, "Don't let the worst thing define you." That's words from Sylvia to you, to all of us. Don't let the worst thing define you. And I think she's able to say that because for a significant time of her life, the worst thing did define her. I remember her saying that that she felt like her house, even though she was able to pay off her house note because of an insurance settlement from the accident that killed her husband and child, she had this house that she didn't want to leave because it was the home that she brought her child home to and the place that she and her husband had bought together. It was her place, and she didn't want to leave her place, but she also decided that it was a place that other people wouldn't want to come to because it was a sad place. See what she did? She decided for other people in advance how they would respond to an invitation, so she didn't extend it. I remember learning while I was doing some really significant fundraising at one point in my life, and we had a consultant that would say, your assignment is to go to this person and ask for this gift. And sometimes you'd want to say, well, yeah, but they're not going to want to give it because they just gave to the opera. They just gave to the Cancer Society. A lot of large gifts are made public. And so you learn that this donor just gave this other. You can create reasons why somebody won't want to take your invitation. And I remember our consultant saying, you have no right to decide for other people what they will do before you even give them an opportunity to say yes or no. Doesn't that make sense? Do you ever do that in your own thinking? Do you decide ahead of time that someone would not want any part of you? Think junior high, maybe. Did you ever think that, like in romantic terms, that someone you might have been interested was out of your league? And so you don't even let them know of your interest. You get the point, don't you? That make sure that you're not allowing bossy thoughts to confine you and sadden you, especially early in the day. Determine that at the beginning of the day, as best you're able, to say, I'm going to have a happy day today. Even in grief, I'm going to do the best I can to have a happy day today. Do you remember the story of Samuel the clothier that's also in book three? He told us that by the time he was in his late teens, he was pretty sure that he was a homosexual man in a time and place where, had that been known, it would have been a great disgrace. And then he said, once I arrived at that truth, I had a decision to make. And he said, I determined that I would live a happy life. I really admired that in him, that he was able to do that as such a young person, because that set him up for a career that was very productive, and he did lead a happy life. Well, I just believe that we can determine a terminus, an end. That I am going to be useful today. I'm going to be of service today. I'm going to have a purposeful day. I'm going to have joy today. I'm 68 years old. I've been through grief before, and I know that it can be hard, but I also know that you don't have to let it boss you around. I won't let grief be the boss of me, and I hope you won't either. You know how in Alcoholics Anonymous and all the other 12-step programs that have spun off from it, you might not, as an alcoholic, have the willpower to say it and mean it. I am never going to take a drink ever again. Amen. But that doesn't mean you can't get to a meeting. You're still in charge of your own motion. You can get your butt out of the chair and get to a meeting. Can you do that? And then once there, they don't let you make these solemn proclamations that I'll never again touch a drop. One of their mottos is one day at a time. And then if you've ever worked that process, you know that sometimes it's not just one day at a time. It might be 1 hour at a time, or 1 minute at a time, the present moment. Say, I don't know that I will succeed in overcoming this addiction, but at least for today, I'm not drinking, or at least for then in the next hour. I just think that attitude of determining that I'm not going to be bossed around by my own thoughts and negative emotions is really important early in the day. All right, I might have just beaten a dead horse there. Maybe I've got overdone it, but well, in AA, to follow that analogy, which I opened up, it's not really all about the individual, because the individual needs the group. And so one of the benefits or the lessons there is, in whatever your circumstance is, try not to be the Lone Ranger and think that that I'm the master of all I survey. I'm going to live this day in the presence of other people. And one way to do that, I was taught, was this is not exactly upon rising, but maybe in the first hour, at least before you go out the door, is to think of what are the expected encounters of the day. I keep a day planner, and so I look at it somewhere in the first hour of the day just to refresh my memory, and maybe even to help me get dressed. What is it? Who am I going to be with, and how do I want to appear? And so moving through the part of a day, even if it's a day like yesterday, I knew that I needed to do my banking, and I knew that I needed to go to the computer repair store to have a little update on my computer. But I prayed my way into both encounters. I prayed for the people who would be at the bank, all the people who worked there and anybody else that was doing their banking at the time I arrived. I prayed for the people at the computer store, whoever they would be. I prayed that I would get the good customer service that I hoped to have and needed. And all that worked. It's not that hard to do. Anybody can have a spiritual practice of some sort where you bless ahead of time whoever you're going to be around. And while you're blessing other people, you're probably not going to be all bound up in your own pain. It takes you out of that, at least for a bit. This morning I went to morning prayer with my community, and the chapel is all decorated for Easter, because as I'm recording this, it's Thursday of Easter week. We call it the octave of Easter. The 8 days of Easter are particularly solemn for us. So our morning prayer is a little more sung and solemn, and the church is decorated with all kind of flowers and joy. I was thinking of the word Easter, and I looked it up, and it wasn't surprising. It's from the word East, Easter. Well, East, for people who live on this planet, everybody has an East. Everybody can look East. Easter has to do with the rising sun and new possibility, the opportunity to start fresh because it's a new day. So you could, whether you're Christian or not, you could borrow from us the idea of Easter, because for us, it's not a day. It's a 50-day season that moves towards Pentecost, toward the giving of the Holy Spirit. So liturgically, in our prayer, we're looking east. There's a hymn that we use in the Advent season, which is normally in December, because it precedes Christmas, which is December 25th. The Advent season is usually a few days at the end of November and all the days of December up to Christmas. Think of what we're doing during that season. We start anticipating Christmas by decking the halls and bringing out stuff that seasonal decor that we only use then, putting up lights in the darkness, because at least in the Northern Hemisphere, that's when the light is dying. The winter solstice happens right around Christmas time. That's why Christmas was put there to begin with. But even while we're seeing the days get darker and darker and darker, we're anticipating that the solstice is coming. And at the solstice, the days are going to begin to get incrementally lighter. There's a hymn, an Advent hymn, that is entitled "People Look East." People look east, the time is near of the dawning of the year. And then it goes into cleaning the house and setting the table and the hearth. It has to do with making preparations for the hopeful event that's coming, Christmas. Well, I'm all about joyful hope. It might be that right now you've had every reason to not be joyful. But could you anticipate joy? Could you wait in joyful hope for a day that is a little lighter than this one? That can help move through a period that has understandably dark, hurtful emotions in it. But can you look east? Can you try to be anticipate joy? I've had to do that a number of times, and I know that it can work. We have to be patient with ourselves when we're grieving, but that doesn't mean we need to let it be the boss of us. Remember, don't let the worst thing determine you, define you. One thing that I've recommended on several different occasions is plants. Some of us are pretty removed from nature. We have cubicles and automobiles and computers. Here I am coming to you through technology, but I'm sitting in my room all by myself. One of the things that can be helpful, I think, is to remind ourselves that we belong to the earth, that we're earthlings, we're made of the earth, and it'd be good to be around plants and living things. Even if you think that you're a person who kills plants, that's me. That doesn't mean that I can't possibly nurture something for a little while before it dies. And living things die. So get over it. It might be possible for you to bring a plant or two into your life and have some place in the morning where you're near some plant, living plant that you tend that reminds you that there's new life. You might go to a garden center, particularly one that where there's customer service and where you can talk to a human being and say, you know, I'm not very good at plants, but I'd like to be around something that's living and growing. Can you recommend something for me? And then they'll know things about, you know, light and amount of water and stuff. People that love plants love to teach other people how to take care of them. So you might ask for something simple. And then if it dies, don't blame yourself for that. Living things die. But anyway, I just think it can be good to be next to a plant. You've heard me say this before, perhaps, that remember, green plants throw off waste oxygen, and you and I throw off waste carbon dioxide. The green plants need our carbon dioxide to live. They suck it up as soon as we send it to them. The other way around, we can be in a little cycle of life just by sitting next to a plant and breathing your carbon dioxide onto it. Sometimes I do that just to get rid of negative emotion inside me. Not that I want to hurt the plant. I just want to feed it my carbon dioxide. Here, you can have this and I'll take your oxygen. How about that? So I think it can be helpful to have something green and growing around you. I was recently at my sister's house in suburban Houston, and looking out from her kind of breakfast nook, there's a little squirrel toys. There's lots of squirrels in her yard, and so they've built things that the squirrels can spin in, and they can reach for a corn cob. And so there's this little squirrel playground thing. And then across, further deep into the yard, they had bluebirds in a birdhouse that was designed for bluebirds. Apparently, bluebirds have a particular set of things that they want and where they build a nest, and it worked. And they were watching a family of a mom and dad bluebirds guarding the nest, and then now feeding the little ones. So anyway, being around nature, pets, that can lift the spirit and get one help one start the day positively. Finally, there's a prayer that I like that comes from St. Paul. He's a friend of mine. His letters comprise a really large chunk of the New Testament. There's a place where he says, "Dismiss all anxiety from your minds and fill your minds full of thanksgiving." He uses the military metaphor of being in charge as a commanding officer and saying, "Anxiety, you are dismissed. You are to leave my presence because I'm dismissing you." I do that sometimes and just say to a persistent, negative, sad thought, "You're dismissed. I heard you. You can come back later, but you're not welcome here now. Go somewhere else." So dismiss all anxiety from your minds and fill your hearts full of thanksgiving. If we can start the day with gratitude for anything that you can be grateful for any part of your body that doesn't hurt, you know, everything that's working, for a roof over my head and for food to eat, for sunshine, for people who love me, you know, just do it's. It's really just folk wisdom to count your blessings. And you can do that on your worst day ever or on your deathbed. You can be thankful for whoever, you know, attends to you, whoever visits, or for whatever, just being cared for at all. We can always count our blessings. You don't have to wait for a wonderful day to do that. Today can be the wonderful day if you allow it to be. So I think that's about enough. I hope I wasn't too cheery for you if you are in grief. And all I'm really trying to do is say that yes, there'll be days that are painful and dark, but there are ways to move through them. And in the end, one of the things that's been important for me is to be of service. And I want to be of service every day. I don't have to be at my best to serve someone. Sylvia said that she didn't really need to work anymore, and she could have been a lady of leisure. But she said, what would have been the point of that? At least my job gave me a reason to get up, get dressed, and leave the house. And she said, I never had my best energy to give to my employer, but I at least gave them an honest day's work. So she had a purpose and something to do. If you don't feel like there's enough purpose to your life, well, then find one. Explore, look around a little bit. Volunteer, even short-term volunteerism can at least kind of let you put the toe in the water. See if you might like this, maybe helping at an animal shelter or a soup kitchen or some place where somebody is going to benefit because you showed up and did whatever it is you do. So I keep thinking that I'm ending this and I'm still here, but I think I'm finally at the end of this episode of The Joyful Friar. Remember, if you want to be in touch with me, you can do that through my website, nathan-castle.com. If you send me an email, a form comes up that gives you gives me an idea of where you are and how I might contact you. And remember that if you're watching this or listening to this podcast, I'm praying for you. I already prayed for you this morning, and I'll continue to pray for whatever it is that you need most. For now, this is Father Nathan Castle. Thanks for being a part of this episode of the Joyful Friar podcast. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Joyful Friar. Please like, follow, and subscribe. You can visit me at nathan-castle.com. Send me a message by clicking the contact button. God bless.